From the 1840s, men from the islands were being brought to Australia to work, but it was not until the 1860s that the trade known as blackbirding began, the trade that would bring in the end over 60,000 Kanakas, as the men were called, to cut cane in Queensland until the new federal government put an end to the system. A new book on this terrible trade has been written by the historian Ryan Butter. Blackbirding, it's called. Blackbirding, A Reckoning with the Australian Slave Trade. Just published, the book explores in particular the early years of the trade and its connection to the slave trades of both the West Indies and of Peru. Ryan joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Ryan, it all begins, doesn't it, with men from the islands working on boats. They showed that they were willing to work and to travel and that they were very good workers. Now, I'm sort of going back to the 1830s here, but it was clear to everybody really early on that there was a kind of pool of labour out there.
Correct. And I think it starts in the sandalwood industry. So that was a big industry in the 1830s. And they're using Pacific Islanders as crews on these boats. And so they're leaving Sydney and they're going out into the Pacific. They're cutting sandalwood, they're processing sandalwood, and they're selling it into China. They're using them on the whaling ships as well. And so there is this knowledge that there is this, I would say, cheap labor, because even that was exploited labor, in that they would operate on a lay system. So you would get a cut of the season's profits, and then at the end of the season, many of these Pacific Islander workers, and also Maori and First Nations, found that the costs that they'd run up were exactly equivalent to the profit they'd
strange,
made.
Strange, wasn't it?
You Very know, strange.
Their food and bedding costs exactly, yep. But then in the 1840s, Ben Boyd appears on the scene, and he has a much more determined plan to exploit this labour.
His plan isn't to exploit this labour initially. His plan is to exploit convict labour.
But then that runs out.
It stops just before he arrives. So he arrives in the colony of New South Wales in 1843. So there's no more convict transportation. But there is a debate. Do we start convict transportation? The free migrant system was under scrutiny because it was costing too much. And what the squatters found was when the free migrants came out, they didn't want to work. They wanted to be squatters.
Or they were no good in the bush.
Or they were no good in the bush. They wanted to stay in the cities. And so the squatters wanted to bring more convicts. Now, the convicts that were already here and the working class, they didn't want to be competing with convicts. And the argument was, why would anyone come out from Britain if they're going to live next to convicts? So it was going to be who does the work. Ben Boyd had an idea to bring up, he wanted to bring up around 10,000 ticket of leave convicts from Tasmania. And he had extensive lands to work them as shepherds, and he couldn't get that. And so I hypothesize in the book, he then said, well, if I can't have the convicts, I'm going to bring black people into the colony. And for me, that was very much a scare tactic to try to provoke the government to allow him to have these convicts from Tasmania.
Yeah, I don't think people generally understand that the labor shortage in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s in Australia just drove politics. Just how do we find workers? And particularly in the north, for all the promise of the tropics, nobody really wanted to work there.
No, and not only find labour, it had to be cheap labour.
Oh, yes.
And because I think they were brought up, the Australian colonists were brought up on convict labour. You couldn't get any cheaper. And so when that stops or it starts to run out, where do you turn to for this labour? And they tried all sorts of things. They tried Chinese labour, Indian labour, but for various reasons that didn't work out.
The Indians were a bit bolshy, weren't they? They would refuse to work and do all sorts of outrageous things.
But also it was the British government that was controlling the labour in Britain. So to bring Indian labourers out, you had to have a migration agent at the other end, which would inform people of the contract, would translate the contract for them. You had to have certain medical supplies on board the ships. You had to have surgeons on the ships, all extra cost. And so it proved a bit too costly.
So when they began to, let's use the euphemism, recruit labour in the islands, none of those none of those things were required, were they? Medicines, contracts, advice, none of that?
No, it was completely unregulated. So that first shipment or cargo, as it was called, of humans that Ben Boyd brought across, they arrived in Boydtown, which is down near modern-day Eden.
I'm a little bit further north. Okay. You're clean.
No. I have been down there, and you can go and see Ben Boyd Tower, and you can have tea and scones at his house. It's all very civilized from where it came from. And he brings in 67 Pacific Islanders, and they land at Boydtown. They're near naked. They can't speak or read or write English. And they all arrive with signed work contracts, which commits them to work for Ben Boyd for 5 years, which is amazing. The Justice of the Peace refuses to sign the contracts. We can obviously see that they're a sham. And he marches these people off to the Monero. And of course, they flee.
This is Ben Boyd.
This is Ben Boyd. And they flee and they try to make their way back to Sydney to get back to their island homes.
Do they succeed?
Not many do. Some are taken back by some ships from the owned by French Jesuits, who Ben Boyd then accuses them of kidnapping his men.
Yeah.
Many hang around Sydney. It's reported that a lot of them were working on the docks. And then one unfortunate, many died. There was one known story that there was one gentleman who, as it is at Neutral Bay, and he sees the ship that brought him out in Neutral Bay. And he swims out. And he swims out to the ship and asks for passage home, and they don't let him on board. And so he makes the swim back and he drowns and he's found washed up on Neutral Bay. And it goes to court to try and work out what's happened to him, and he's one of Ben Boyd's men. That gentleman ends up in the Australian Museum on display.
So it's Towns, this man Towns, though, that begins to import to what's now become Queensland from 1859, workers to work from the islands to work. Was it originally in the forlorn attempts to grow cotton?
Correct. They were trying to grow cotton.
There was a problem with cotton, wasn't it? Because in Queensland, it rains at the wrong time of year.
Yeah, I'm not 100%.
Yeah, I think that it's a simple It's a simple weather problem, I think. No, the summers need to be dry for cotton and the summers in Queensland are wet. Anyway, cotton fails, sugar takes over.
Correct. But the important thing about the cotton was they were telling themselves they were growing it in attempt to help stop slavery in the US. It's very much connected to the US Civil War. After Abraham Lincoln blockades the South, we think, well, we will supply the cotton to Lancashire. It fails miserably. And then a couple of years later, they're using slavery to grow the cotton, which is then by then they've transformed the fields into sugarcane fields.
Towns has his own connection to the slave trade, doesn't he?
No. He is connected, apart from his own use of slavery in Australia, he doesn't come from a slave trading family. Benjamin Boyd comes from a slave trading family.
My mistake. It was Boyd who had... Boyd was using slave money, essentially.
His family were big into the slave trade.
Yeah.
But others in Queensland, contemporaries of Towns, Lewis Hope, his family were big into the slave trade as well.
We were talking the other day on the show about the influx of slave money into Australia after the compensation payments of 1833. Out in the Pacific, ships are now, again, euphemism, recruiting workers for the sugarcane fields. How were they being recruited?
A number of ways. And it's important to stress that these Australian ships didn't just invent these ways. It came through trial and error from the Peruvian slave trade, which was started by an Australian gentleman. And so they'd worked out what worked best. And you see the techniques used in the Peruvian trade were then adopted by the people that was working for Towns.
Ryan, let's stop there for a moment. The Peruvian slave trade supplied out of the Pacific.
Correct.
By Australian traders.
By an Australian man started it. An Australian colonist, originally from Ireland. He got permission from the president of Peru to import free colonists, in scare quotes. And that kicked off a slave trade that lasted for 7 months. And it cost the lives of over 6,000 Pacific Islanders.
Who put an end to it?
The French and the British.
Ah, because they were taking men from French islands.
They were taking men from the Loyalty Islands, from the Marquesas. And so the French kicked up a diplomatic fuss. The British were a bit slow to respond. They dragged their foot. They said, well, we actually don't know which islands are protectorates of ours. But they eventually got on board. They brought a lot of diplomatic pressure. They were all returned back into the Pacific Islands. But of the 3,500 that had landed in Peru, maybe only 150, 200 survived. But those 200 that were transported back took with them smallpox.
And killed how many?
Another 3,000.
So it was in this brutal little episode that the traders worked out how you got a Melanesian, Polynesian, Micronesian man from an island to a ship. How did they do it?
So a common way was to mix rum with opium and drug them, bring them aboard. They would lure them to look at trinkets and things on the beach, and then that happened at Easter Island, then basically just capture. Weapons, capture them. A common way that was sort of pioneered by Australian ships later on was that they would approach the island, the locals would come out in their canoes, they would drop lumps of iron, maybe small cannon, over the side, put a hole in the canoe, sink it, and then simply scoop them out of the water. And that was a common method used by Australian ships. They'd pretend to be missionaries, and they would just invite them on board and then invite them down into the hold to inspect the axes or the rifles or the tobacco, and then simply shut the hold and sail off.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Ryan Butter about his new book on the blackbirding trade. Now, Ryan, we're talking about the very first years in the 1860s, aren't we, before there was any attempt to regulate the trade at all. How did the first attempt go at trying to clean up this business at least a little?
Well, I make the point in the book that when the Queensland Parliament had a chance to outlaw the trade, they instead decided to legalise it. So Robert Townes brought the first people in 1863. The first legislation, the Polynesian Labourers Act, passed in February of 1868. And it had clauses which would sort of regulate that no one was kidnapped and you'd have to pay a bond that nobody was kidnapped, certain conditions of clothing, etc. But all of this was happening, the recruitment was happening in faraway Pacific Islands with no British presence. It wasn't like getting labour from India where there was a government that could look out for the needs or the rights of these people. There was nothing. So who knew what was going on in the recruitment? And then, of course, they all arrived at the Brisbane docks with signed labour contracts, committing them to work for 3 years. And you know, in 1867, just prior to the legislation, you know, there's newspaper advertisements advertising if you wanted to buy a man at Brisbane for £7. But that 1863 to 1868 was completely unregulated.
When a Kanaka did arrive in Brisbane, what happened then? Were they sent to employers who'd already signed up? Were they sold like slaves? What happened to them on the docks?
So there was a number of ways it could work. And again, there's advertisements from middlemen, very much like stock and station agents, and with the stock being humans. And they'd put an advertisement in, you know, the Sir Isaac Newton is sailing for the Pacific Islands. Put your order in for men. And then other times planters themselves would get amongst themselves and hire a ship and send it off. Other times people would arrive, we've arrived, we've got 200 natives, as they would say, to sell. And people would. And there's a really interesting diary I came across, Claudius Wish. He was a sugarcane planter, contemporary of Robert Townes, outside of Brisbane, later a member of the Queensland Parliament. And in his diary, he talks about, oh, there's a ship come in. I'm going to go down and inspect the lads. And I got a bargain. You know, I got 20 for £200. And it was very much like they were buying livestock.
All this time, there were citizens protesting at what was going on, were there not?
Probably from 1867 onwards. There was a gentleman called Robert Short. Now, he'd come out of the West Indies. And one of the great...
He knew what he was looking at.
He knew what slavery was. He knew when he saw it. Because the myth at the time was this is indentured labour. And the indentured labour system itself had come in to replace slave labour when slavery was abolished in the 1830s. And so they came up with indentured labour, which gave you all the benefits of slavery without the bad look of it. And so...
Plus a wage.
Plus a wage, a very minimal wage.
Yep. But because also, we are talking about the men brought into Australia, they were paid.
They were paid, but not often in currency. So to give you an example, Robert Townes, he appeared before a royal commission in 1869, held here in New South Wales.
We'll get to that, yep.
And he admitted that he never paid his people in money. And his reason was, because if I pay them in money, other nefarious settlers will rob them.
Huh. So there were people saying this is a rotten system as it flourished. Now, the terms of an indenture, that did guarantee a return to the island, didn't it?
In theory.
This was not a one-way journey.
No. No, in theory. So every planter had to pay £5 for every person that they brought in, and that was their return passage. But again, what guarantee they were going to the island they came from? And what guarantee that they would be alive to go home?
They're separate things. What about women? Were women brought?
Very few women. So I think...
Women and families with these men?
No, because women and families were another mouth to feed, which was a cut into the profit. So I think over the 45 years of this trade, I think 10% of the estimated 60,000 were women. They were targeting young men. I'm going to say boys. So Robert Townes' instructions were to bring back 14 to 18-year-olds. Women, there was heavily regulated where these people could work. They were only allowed to work initially in sugarcane and pastoral. That later became just sugarcane, so they weren't to be used for domestic servants. And the going home, which sounds like, oh, that's a good thing. Why did that come about? It came about because they didn't want to repeat the mistakes of slavery in the US, where they came and they stayed.
And a big community
and
of
a large
black
community
grew up.
They were, and they've seen the revolts in Haiti, and they've seen this agitation and the revolts in Jamaica. We don't want that happening here. And so it was a way to placate the people who really feared for the racial purity, that ridiculous notion, of Australia. And so it was, yes, we have to use black labour because white people can't work in the tropics, but don't worry, we'll send them home. It's not going to, what happened in the United States isn't going to happen here. We can send them home whenever we need to send them home.
Mm. And it also has to be said, doesn't it, that one of the reasons that made Kanaka labour so appealing is that they were very good workers.
Well, they were very good workers, but even that was that sort of myth that only they could work in the tropics. And yet, David, they died by their thousands.
Yeah.
And so they were worked to death. And so I don't think, you know, I think there was racial stereotype and prejudice about how good of workers they were. You still had to feed them. You still had to water them. You still had to clothe them. And that didn't happen in a lot of cases.
I was just thinking for a moment that sort of roll on 70 or 80 years, and it was Greeks and Italians that could work in the cane fields. Remember that?
The dark-skinned.
The dark-skinned.
Southerners.
Southerners. They could work in the cane fields.
Yeah.
It is on record, and it is discussed by some historians, that the Kanakas, having done their term in Australia, many of them signed up and came back again for another term. How does that fit with the notion that they were slaves?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, David. And you're correct, a lot did re-enlist. And I will say that some people came voluntarily as well, so it's not cut and dried. Re-enlistment as proof that the conditions weren't that bad, it's an argument that's been floated since probably 1878 by the planters to show things aren't that bad. Now, at the time, people have refuted it. In 1883, George Morrison, journalist and later sort of diplomat up in China, he went on a slave return ship. His view was that one reason they re-enlist is because when they go back home, the village is no longer there, their wife is no longer there, the life they knew was no longer there, and so they re-enlist. In 1893, Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, he'd spent a lot of time in the Pacific. He said he'd spoken to a lot of blackbirders. His view was that a common way to get people to re-enlist was they take them from Queensland, anchor offshore from an island that's not friendly to the clan that they're from, and give them the option. Do you want us to land you here, or do you want to come back to Queensland and re-enlist? So there's those. But also a really interesting insight is in 1906, when we deport them, they make a petition. Representatives of the Pacific Island community make a petition and give their reasons for not wanting to go home. And sometimes they've married women here. Yes. They've got children here. They fear that they've married a woman from the wrong clan, and when they go home, they'll be killed. So there's lots and lots of reasons why they re-enlist. Some, they might have wanted the money. They might have thought it was a good deal. But I think it's important to remember, they were making a choice. The people who re-enlisted were making a choice to re-enlist. But that choice doesn't mean they had complete freedom. And you have to think that they're in a colonial power structure. We don't know how they came. We don't know what they're... They might have had three bad options, and enlisting was the best.
Mm.
So you don't know. Now, if you want to talk about the conditions on the plantations, I think how people interact with a system is a bad or a poor indicator of how good or bad the system is. But we do have testimony of what was going on the plantations, and it was pretty grim.
Let's quickly look at the geography here, because Captain Robert Townes, of course, becomes Townesville. And while the trade is moving, the trade in men is moving from Oceania, from all of the islands into Queensland, the money is in Sydney, is that right?
Correct. When I started this story, I think like a lot of Australians, I associated blackbirding with Queensland, with sugar cane. But the heart of it was in Sydney for many, many years. The men ended up in Queensland. But Robert Townes was a member of New South Wales Parliament. Ben Boyd, for a while, was a member of New South Wales Parliament. There was some French in Sydney who started an aborted slave trade to Reunion Island in 1858. They were based in Sydney. So it was all coming out of Sydney. One of the big trading firms, Burns Philp, James Burns was based in Sydney. CSR Sugar, we've still got the sugar wharves here. They're processing sugar grown with slave labour. Who are the shareholders? John Fairfax. In 1869, the French make a complaint to the British government that the Australian subjects are kidnapping people from the Loyalty Islands. So it's the Peruvian trade all over again.
Yeah.
They hold a Royal Commission, and they hold the Royal Commission in Sydney because the majority of the boats were owned and registered to Sydney business people.
And the Royal Commission becomes this window into the trade, but it doesn't stop the trade. What in the end stopped blackbirding?
The White Australia policy. So
simple answer. But for the White Australia policy, it would have continued?
Yeah, 100%. Because this was... They tried to stamp it out in 1892 after some really egregious atrocities, even more so than the common in the early 1880s. Griffith, the Queensland Premier, said, we're going to ban this.
Please, Sir Samuel Griffith.
Sorry, my mistake. Sir Samuel Griffith placed a ban on the trade and said, we're going to phase it out by 1892. Well, come 1890, there's a depression, sugarcane's not doing so well, the only way we can survive is with cheap labour. And so Griffith is back, Sir Samuel is back in power, and he overturns his own ban, and it continues. Federation starts to bubble along, driven by Sir Henry Parkes, who has no doubt and no qualms about calling this a slave trade. Edmund Barton's involved. It's a slave trade. We cannot have a federated Australia that is not racially pure. And so the other colonies saw Queensland as a backdoor. Again, they've got an eye on what's happened in the United States. Queensland are going to let black people into the country. And if we want federation, and we want a federation that's worth having, it must be white. And so, as you will know, and your listeners will know, one of the first pieces of legislation through our federated parliament was the White Australia policy. And it took Queensland by surprise. They thought they were going to have 15 years to phase this out. And they said, nope, by 1904, no more can come. And by 1906, they're all sent home.
Well, not all. because their presence is still with us.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. The idea was to send them all, but there were some carve-outs. If you'd been here before 1879, I think it was, and there were certain rules that allowed some of them to stay, but the intention was to get rid of them all if they could.
And luckily, they didn't.
Oh, it's immensely lucky. But they've tried to forget them. You know, I found an article from 1948, and it was called The Last Kanaka.
Oh, The Last Tasmanian. It was Last Kanaka.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we can put that to bed because there's no more left. And, of course, it's untrue, and it's such a vibrant, beautiful community. And I've been lucky to engage with the descendant community for pieces of writing the book, and it's I can guarantee you they are alive and they are well and they are fierce, and we're lucky to have that community in Australia.
Ryan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have been talking to Ryan Butter, who is the author of Blackbirding, A Reckoning with the Australian Slave Trade, just published. This is Late Night Live.